It's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
It is time for This Week in History, and tonight we're heading to New York in 1911. Do you put a bit of a New York theme tonight? We might have to play New York, New York a bit later on. But we're going to New York at a time where the garment industry was really, really at its peak. We're taking you to a 10-story building in Greenwich Village called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, where close to 1,000 garment workers were busy on this day finishing their work. It was Saturday, March the 25th, back in 1911. Now, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory occupied three floors, floor 8, floor 9, and floor 10. And in the afternoon around 4 o'clock, on the 8th floor, it's thought that somebody dropped a cigarette into a bin, and it contained highly flammable offcuts from the women's shirtwaists, or blouses as they were called, and a fire broke out and it spread quickly thanks to the amount of flammable material around. Now, workers would have rushed for doors, but they found their escape was blocked by both a combination of locked doors, elevators that couldn't operate because of the fire, and a highly inadequate fire escape that collapsed. Well, as you can imagine, a huge tragedy quickly unfolded, and the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire has gone down in US history as the deadliest industrial disaster in the history of New York and one of the deadliest of the United States. It's believed 146 people, 146, mostly immigrant women and girls aged between 14 and 43, died that day. Gosh, sobering to think, isn't it? The only good thing really that came from the tragedy was an overhaul of the city's appalling protection for workers at that time. So to tell you more of the story of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire is Daniel Katz. He's an adjunct professor of history at the City University of New York, and he's the founder and chief historian at People's Heritage Tours in New York. That leads walking tours across the city to keep this story alive. And Daniel joins us tonight on Nightlife. Welcome to Weekend Nightlife.
Thank you very much, Renee. It's very nice. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, indeed. Take us back to 1911, New York City, where the garment industry was in full flight.
Absolutely. Garment industry in New York City in 1911 was one of the largest industries in New York City and, in fact, in New York State. Just for women's garments alone, there were 100,000 mostly immigrant, mostly women workers in the garment industry. And in particular, women's blouses or shirtwaists employed 40,000 women. And there were about 500 different factories, some of them in old style tenement sweatshops, that is, people working where they lived in terrible squalor, terrible conditions, terribly dangerous, up into modern factories. And in fact, paradoxically, the Triangle factory was among the most modern factories, and it was the largest. They employed 500 workers in a building that was filled with garment factories. They had the top three floors, as you said. The women were packed in tightly. In as modern as it was, there were too many people. You touched on a few of the major fire hazards that had to do with both the design of the building and the conditions that the owners kept the workshops in.
Yeah. Now, this is a story that I know so well because just a few years ago, I was in New York, lucky me, and I did one of these tenement tours. Someone said, you've got to do a tenement tour. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it was, Dan. It really was. The conditions, as you've just described, were appalling. They were so unsafe.
They were terrible. I bet you went to the Tenement Museum.
I did.
Which is an extraordinary museum that was created in one of the old tenement buildings Those tenement buildings exist all over Manhattan. Many of them are now multi-million dollar cooperatives. and with retrofitting and air conditioning, it has changed. But if you go back to this period, it was not unusual for 10 or 12 people to live in three rooms. And during the day, the front room facing the street would be transformed into a workshop. Whole families would be working, small children, older relatives as well, and they'd be working in a condition called sweating. It was a sweated condition in which the large, magnificent department stores, Tiffany's and Klein's and Macy's and many others, Wanamaker's, would contract with middlemen whose job was to go out and find workers, and they would hire people in their tiny little, families in their tiny little sweatshirt or tenement apartments, and they would have them compete with one another. So people would compete for the lowest price possible just to get work, and then they would take people fresh off the boat, literally fresh off the boat, and hire them and maybe put them up in the apartment and give them just enough money to eat when there was work. There was the disease was rife throughout the tenement districts. There was typhus, there was tuberculosis, there was cholera. It was terrible. And there were fire conditions as well.
We'll get to the fire. Let's get to the fire. But I just want to touch on when you say they're immigrants, they were largely from one part of the world, weren't they?
From Europe, from Eastern and Southern Europe. The victims who died in the fire really reflect what the largest group of immigrants in New York City at the time. The largest group were Jewish immigrants. They were coming from persecution in what was then the Russian Empire, from Poland and from many of the other Eastern European countries and from Russia itself. And the second largest group was from Italy, and they were escaping crushing poverty.
And you say 100,000 of them working in this these area in these tenements, all day, all night, living and working in these terrible conditions where they couldn't really even have a break. You know, they were sort of, you know, they were almost sort of slave workers, weren't they? If you like. So let's talk about the fire. So did the fire start from a cigarette?
That's the best guess. There are any number of things that could have sparked the fire, but likely it was a cigarette. That was the assumption. And one of the many laws that was passed subsequent to the fire had to do with making it illegal to smoke within factories in New York State. So that's the assumption. Everyone agreed who gave testimony that the fire started in a wicker bin underneath the cutters table. The cutters were the highest skilled and the highest paid in the industry. They were all men, and they were on the eighth floor. The production process started on the eighth floor, went to the ninth, and then to the tenth floor. And there was a freight elevator that would take the materials and the finished product up and down. So it was quitting time, about 4:30 on a Saturday. Likely someone put a cigarette out and threw it into the bin underneath the cutter's table. Atop the cutter's table were the tissue paper patterns that the cutters would hang on lines above their table. They would take down the pattern if they were cutting maybe a stack of 100 layers of cloth to make the outline of a blouse, for example. And they would make the cut, and they'd put the tissue paper back, and they would take down different tissue paper. It was the absolute worst conditions in that sense, because once the fire started, the tissue paper caught fire, and it would float throughout the entire floor, and all sorts of materials. There was cuttings from the cloth. There was machine oil that would grease the sewing machines and the pressing machines. The sewing machines, by the way, were electrified, so there were electrical wires that went up to the ceiling as well. So the fire spread fast and quickly, and quite a few people, you know, didn't even have a chance to even try to get to the exits because they were simply cut off.
Oh, must have been so horrific. There was just no way for them to get out, as we've discussed. And there's even reports that people were jumping from windows.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the things that made the Triangle Fire so visible in many ways. There were minimally 1,000 people that saw what happened. The building that still exists today, it's actually a New York University classroom building now. There's a chemistry department on the top floors. And it sits only about 100 feet from Washington Square Park, which is an iconic park. If you know nothing about New York City, you have seen this park and the magnificent row houses in dozens of movies and television shows. It was a late winter, early spring afternoon. People were out and about, and so when they saw the smoke and the flames, people came running, and it was just a matter of a few steps away from the park. There was newspaper reporter who came, and there were a number of people who were deeply affected who later became incredibly important to New York State and even American national reforms for decades, who witnessed this terrible scene. Within moments of the fire starting, there was an explosion and a window blew out. People were stepping up onto the sill, and people could see them. And this is only eight, 9 floors up. They could see people stepping onto the sill. They could hear the fire engines turning the corner and see. These were horse-drawn fire engines, but they came fast. They had them in the neighborhood. And they were yelling to people that the fire engines were coming. It was too late. People had to start jumping. Their hair and their clothing were on fire. Someone noticed for the very first body that came down, they said it looked like a bundle of clothes, and they didn't realize until the body was halfway down and the wind blew up their dress, and they could see that it was a person. And one after another, just on the outside of the building, on the street sides, there were 61 bodies that came down. In the back of the building, there was a fire escape that was about 18 inches wide. It couldn't carry the weight of the people who were trying to get down the fire escape, and it also buckled under the heat of the fire and started to twist and pull away from the building. So a few people made it down the fire escape, but many people fell in the back as well off the fire escape.
So 146 people died this day because of this factory fire caused from a cigarette. And the tragedy really is they're so young, 14 years of age, between 14 and 43, these immigrant women and girls. The big question is, was anybody responsible for this?
Absolutely. Certainly the owners were directly responsible. Max Blank and Isaac Harris, they themselves were Jewish immigrants. They had come from Russia about 20 years earlier. They worked their way up in the garment industry, incredibly competitive, cutthroat industry. And they made their way to the top of the industry at 500 factories, more or less. They were the largest, and a couple years before the fire, they reported making $1 million, not even in today's money, $1 million in 1908 dollars from this industry. They lived in these magnificent townhouses, 10-room townhouses on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, a beautiful and wealthy neighborhood. They would take horse-drawn carriages down to work, back and forth to work every day. And they were hypersensitive about every penny spent, everything that they wanted, everything accounted for, pins, thread. Women, young women who were working had to pay for their own materials like thread and pins. And at the end of every day, every single worker was checked. They were forced to open their bags to see whether they were stealing a shirtwaist or cloth or materials of some sort. There was also a lot of labor activity, and there was a major strike the year before that centered it at Triangle. And so the owners were also trying to keep workers from talking to union organizers who might be coming up the staircase and trying to meet them outside on the landing. So they kept the doors locked. And that was against the laws, against the fire code. There was very poor enforcement of what laws that did exist. And it was not even clear what kind of fines would be levied against employers who did such things. It was actually pretty common practice.
Okay. So let's just reestablish. So this is the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire we're talking about from 1911 in New York. Dan Katz is with us. He's the founder and chief historian at People's Heritage Tours of New York, and he leads these walking tours still today and tells this story because it's such an important part of the New York story, really, when it comes to industrial relations. So these two owners of this factory, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory that went down in flames, did they get charged?
Yes. Eventually, the Manhattan District Attorney brought charges of manslaughter against both of them. The charges were levied in April, the following month, and the court case did not take place until December. For 3 weeks, there was a trial that was heavily covered, and there were people in the courtroom, there were people outside the courtroom, demanding justice. At the end of 3 weeks, whether they were innocent or guilty hung on the question of whether they knew that the ninth floor where the doors were locked, whether they knew that they were locked. This is where most of the people who died as a result of the ninth floor. There were about 250, mostly sewing machine operators who were crammed into this 10,000 square foot space. Some of them made it out, but many of them died. And the question was, did they know that the door was locked? And the jury came back and acquitted them because they said it couldn't be determined that they actually knew that the door was locked. A few years later, some of the families of victims brought civil suits against Blank and Harris. And in that civil suit, they were found liable for the deaths, and they were forced to pay $75 per family that sued. The sadness of this is that the Blank and Harris actually had overinsured the building. There were two previous fires, and they actually learned that they could overinsure. They made $60,000 on the insurance loss of the building, and then they only had to pay $75 for a small number of the families who sued.
Gosh. But it's not just the doors. Were the doors locked? The elevators weren't sufficient. The fire escape wasn't appropriate. There were the stairs. Like, the whole entrance and exit to these buildings was not fire safe. And there were so many people crammed into these very small spaces working day in, day out. Clearly the conditions were unsafe and unsound and waiting for some tragedy like this to happen.
That's right. It was known how to build safe spaces, safe factories. The building itself was built in 1901 by Joseph Ashe, a developer, Triangle moved in the following year in 1902. It was built as a fireproof building, and sadly, it actually worked. The building itself stood, and it was later renovated and used again. It was the conditions inside. But even in building that building, Joseph Ashe, the fire code called for three stairwells. And he petitioned the buildings department to build only two stairwells. It would save him money, and argued that the fire escape should have counted as a third, and the buildings department granted him that exemption. Part of that story is a larger story of corruption, because Tammany Hall was the political club that was really the political machine in which graft and corruption was, and payoffs were how the city worked. It's how people got jobs. It's how politicians got elected. And if you had enough money, you could ask for all sorts of exemptions and get it. So whether there was a direct payoff, I don't know. But it certainly was part of the culture. It was also the technology for sprinklers existed. It's actually a fairly simple technology. A little piece of lead gets melted, and then the water comes rushing out. And to save a small percentage of the building costs, he decided not to put in a sprinkler system. And instead, what the factories did, what Triangle did, they put buckets of water by the windows. There were at least two fires at Triangle prior to this fire in years in the past, and the buckets worked then, but it certainly wasn't adequate in 1911.
So the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, you know, sees 146 deaths. Were there other factory fires that happened around this time, or was this the only one?
Oh yeah, and fires were just, it was a fact of life throughout the city, throughout the country. There were still many wooden structures, even when they were, when buildings were starting to be used brick and then later steel. And cement, the conditions that were in Triangle were everywhere. 6 months earlier, there was a fire in Newark, New Jersey. Newark, is right across the river from, Manhattan, across the Hudson River, fairly sizable city. And there was a garment industry there, and there were 25 young women who died under almost exact same circumstances.
Right.
A few years earlier, There was a fire in the East River on the other side of Manhattan, just a few miles from Triangle. There's 1,000 people died by fire and drowning in a pleasure cruise. I mean, this was just part of daily life, and people were aware of it. And there were always demands to improve safety, but then, as now, safety and regulation costs money, and lives were cheaper.
Gosh. It's such a sobering thought when you put it like that, isn't it? That lives are cheap, money rules. So,
yeah.
Dan Katz, did any good? Did any change come off the back of the devastation that was the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire?
Yeah, I think quite a bit did. The most tangible effect was the massive outpouring of grief and rage really helped to push forward the groups that were already organizing. The International Ladies Garment Workers Union had members in that building, and the ILGW is their acronym, and they tried to organize and get a contract in that shop the year before. So the union had a renewed reason and renewed strength among workers to continue to organize and represent them to try to ameliorate these issues. The Socialist Party, the Women's Trade Union League, the American Federation of Labor, these are all groups that had been organizing, and it was focused in that moment. After the fire, there was a huge funeral, which the police conservatively estimated that 400,000 people either marched in or observed the funeral march. There were many, many more garment workers who were watching from the rooftops and from the windows of the factories. And this all led to a push for real state reform, and reform followed. The Tammany Hall politicians, again, who got there through corruption and graft, they agreed to what was called, they established a factory investigating commission. And they put some of these union members, leaders, and middle-class social reformers on this commission, and they gave them real power. This was an extraordinary moment. Even before women had the right to vote, New York State didn't get the right to vote for women until 1917, and the U.S. nationally not till 1920. So even before then, these mostly women inspectors in this commission had the authority to compel people to testify. They can go unannounced into factories all over New York State. And they came up with recommendations that had the force of a committee to resolve in the New York State Senate laws and the New York State Assembly that passed. So over 34 laws that dealt with factory work and fire safety, child labor, maximum hours for women, the conditions of work, everything from the chairs to elevators to doors swinging open rather than into the workplace, which is what happened in Triangle. Many of these laws were passed in the next few years. And those laws then got replicated throughout the country. State after state passed those laws. Eventually, those laws became federal laws. So in the 1930s, one of the people most responsible is a woman named Frances Perkins. Frances Perkins was a social worker. She was a college-educated, middle-class woman, but she was a social worker working in a settlement house in the Lower East Side. And she was working with garment workers and others to try to form unions, as well as ameliorate some of the worst health and safety conditions in the neighborhoods and the workplaces. And she was actually having tea at one of those very famous row houses with a friend who lived there, so a very wealthy friend, on Washington Square Park. They heard the commotion. She came running out, and she saw the bodies falling. She resolved that she would work to redeem the tragedy for the rest of her life. And she did. She became an inspector in the Factory Investigating Commission. She later worked for Al Smith, was a Tammany politician who was head of the assembly. He becomes governor in the 1920s, and he elevates Frances Perkins to become the first secretary, the first commissioner of labor in New York State. When in 1928, Franklin Delano Roosevelt becomes governor of New York State, he right. keeps Frances Perkins as commissioner. Yeah. And then when he becomes president of the United States 4 years later, he names Frances Perkins as the first woman cabinet secretary in U.S. history. And she becomes the Secretary of Labor. And she becomes the number one, the most vociferous, the most ardent supporter of what's called the New Deal. And the New Deal included the 1935 Wagner Act. And this was, again, a Tammany politician, Robert Wagner, who was the head of the Senate during the state Senate during the fire. He later becomes U.S. Senator, and he is the sponsor of the Wagner Act that gives the first nationwide laws that guarantees workers in many industries, not all, but many industries, the right to form unions, negotiate contracts, have those contracts enforced.
Dad,
it really is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an amazing outcome, really. I mean, in spite of such tragedy, it is quite an amazing outcome. We're out of time, but I do want to acknowledge that there is no garment industry in New York anymore. When did it actually peter out?
There is, it petered out in stages. There's a small garment industry left. There's maybe 10,000 workers, and they're working mostly in highly specialized market segments like Broadway, which is a big industry in the theater industry, and the very highly specialized
But really, industry. This whole industry has gone to another part of the world, which we all know is Bangladesh
exactly.
and China, and
in many ways we've exported the industry and the and the dangers of the industry. So you saw a few years ago in Bangladesh, about 10 years ago, the building collapses that killed 1,000 garment workers. The conditions are quite horrendous.
Dissimilar than what you've described from 1911. Thank you so much. It's such an incredibly important part of New York's history and indeed the United States history when it comes to labor and workers' rights. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Renee.
The story of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, New York, 1911.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.